Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, yes, it's me again, Luke Jones, not Matt Chorley. This is the Times Red Box podcast. Ahead, how to take over a business as Morrison's is in the middle of a massive bidding scuffle. We'll tell you how to take over your favourite company. First, our columnists, David Finkelstein, Danny Finkelstein, and David Aronovich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelvich with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Bit much? How have I not heard that before?
Well, it doesn't really go together with our favourite meals, does it? I mean, all that kind of snarling and stuff like that, and nice kind of Friday evenings with your family.
I've always wondered what portmanteau meant. Maybe that's what it means. What's your favourite meal?
Yeah. let us start, you two, with, well, the thing that's on the front of all the pages today. The situation in Kabul, race to escape Kabul carnage, is the front page of the Times, with a still from that awful video where that US Air Force plane is trying to take off, and just hundreds of people are crowding around it, trying to cling to the bottom of it. There's lots of quite angry commentary in the papers today. Danny, what did you think when you saw some of those pictures yesterday? Some of the really desperate pictures.
Look, it's often been a great theme of British politics. You know, there's American has too much power. The Americans should go home. The Americans shouldn't exercise influence in the world. And the truth is, there they are flying out, and people are actually clinging on to the aeroplane. I think that was a pretty eloquent image. I mean, it's the whole thing is shameful as far as I'm concerned, but it also illustrates the value that American power has to some of the people who are living in that country.
And David, what about you?
I'm ashamed, but my shame accomplishes nothing right now. And so if you're genuinely kind of ashamed, then in that case, the real response is to try and see what you can do about it. Clearly, we're into the business of discussing how it is that we can get people out. But I don't think we should just be looking at the short term. I think, unfortunately, we've got to be looking at negotiating with whatever administration the Taliban eventually kind of puts up, to try and allow as many people as possible who want to live in conditions of relative liberty to come out of Afghanistan and go to places where they can live like that. And I do think that's part of our responsibility. And if we don't see that as part of our responsibility, then the rest, frankly, is cant.
And
yeah, you know, David, actually, just so to be clear, because I've written in the past, as David knows, about immigration control, I really agree with you about that. Indeed, it's one of the reasons why I think we have to be careful about economic migrants, is that we sometimes need to take action in these kind of circumstances. One of the reasons why I believe in us trying to help countries and people where they live with military action is so that they don't feel driven out of their homes. But
exactly.
Now that we've failed in that respect, we have a moral responsibility, and I think we need to be very generous in our response to it. I wouldn't have wanted to be in this position, but we absolutely are, and we need to respond as if we are.
We're awaiting news about what the government is actually going to do in terms of a plan to resettle Afghan refugees. Henry Zeffren from The Times, chief political correspondent, was reporting last night that ministers are preparing a distinct scheme like the Syrian refugee resettlement programme that we had in 2015, plans for a direct route under a specific pathway. That's encouraging, David, isn't it? But we don't yet know about numbers.
Well, we didn't. I mean, that was a good scheme, but it hardly took any Syrians. I think it was about 20,000 in all. And as we know, a good 800,000 went to Germany. Firstly, we should say this. We're not just talking about ourselves. This has got to be done in concert with other people. Mm. And it's a shame that the concert is so much more difficult to achieve now than it was, but it's got to be done together with other people. This is not an area for unilateralism, really. Unilateralism just doesn't kind of work here. And the second thing is, it's got to be, given our historic connections with Afghanistan, a much bigger package than we offered to the Syrian refugees. There are many, many more people with an orientation towards the United Kingdom and with links both with us historically and more recently with our armed forces, with our NGOs and with people who've been working in Afghanistan.
But Danny, this is the question, isn't it? It's about scale. How far do you actually extend this scheme? Where is the cutoff point?
Look, you know, you'd expect someone from a family like mine, which has had to flee for its life in more than one place, to take the view that we have both the responsibility, not just established by our strategic interventions in Afghanistan, but also established by our moral responsibility as human beings. And, you know, the fact it's certainly not optimal either for people to have to be forced to leave their home, which they want to live in the country that they know, and become strangers in another land. That's not something they want to do, but it's something that they may have to do. And in those circumstances, we have to respond as the moment suggests, and other considerations, I'm afraid, become secondary in those circumstances, even though, you know, they're some of my concerns. But, you know, we have to respond to the emergency that's been created.
And there's a question, isn't there, about why there's a scramble to sort this out now? Talks reportedly happening through the night on sorting out this scheme. We just heard from Lord Dannett a few minutes ago, and he was saying that central government in August has not been looking at Afghanistan. He talks about how there was a scant mention of Afghanistan in the integrated review. We're getting stories like in the Times today of this Afghan interpreter whose permission to come to Britain has been revoked, telling the Times that his home has now been raided by the Taliban and they've sentenced him to death. Why has government, David, actually turned a blind eye, in Lord Dannett's view, to this for so long?
And we've all been asleep. I was just looking at some of the stuff going back to the presidential election, and then some of the things even before that that Joe Biden had said about Afghanistan, and it was all there to be seen if you were looking for it. But we were looking at other things. We were looking in another direction. We just didn't imagine. As ever, we all think, and we always think this, and often it's true, that the Americans have a plan, that they know something, and that consequently something like this won't happen in the way it did. And it turns out that they didn't really have a plan, and they, whatever they thought they knew turned out not to be quite right. It might be right long term, but it certainly wasn't right in the short term. But we expected it to be. Mm. So we've all been asleep. Well, I have been kind of sorry.
Yeah, just our colleague William Hague on in his column, he did say this would happen. And I admit, I'm completely open to admit that before I read it, I've been completely oblivious to this. But about a 6 weeks ago, he wrote warning precisely that this would happen. And I read it and I thought, do you know what? I think that's completely convincing. I assume that there's some sort of response to the points that he's making, but it does seem to me to be, his judgment does seem to me to be correct. So it was there to know.
Oh, no, I completely agree. And I actually, for what it's worth, I was kind of tweeting and doing social media posts about this months ago, saying this looks really bad. But I did not conceive that the Americans had not got some kind of big notion in place about it not happening within a week.
Yes. And as well, there's a question of how much of this is sublettered to US forces. Tom Tugendhat, I think it was when I was on Drive last week on the Thursday or Friday, was saying that some aspects of UK foreign policy at the moment are God bless America. Is that fair, David?
America is the essential ally. It's the superpower. It's, you know, 1941 and the 1940, the arsenal of democracy. If you're going to have any really substantial international fight, then in that case, you want to have the Americans on your side. And that's a, and it's a very difficult position we're in. We're both at the same time significantly dependent upon America. And also reluctant to try and create forces which would release us from that degree of dependency. And so the actual real position is that we need to take America with us, and we need to be taken with America. But that has really substantial costs and problems associated with it. And if you don't want to do that, then in that case, you've got to look at what your alternatives are. And by and large, we've not embraced the alternatives, like massive builds up of our own forces or the possibility of a significant European dimension.
And why isn't there some kind of honesty, Danny, about this from our government? I mean, I think we got close to it with Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, the other day, in tears, saying, you know, this has happened because the West has done what it's done. But they still seem quite cautious of calling out US decisions which they don't necessarily feel comfortable with.
Well, it's difficult because we are quite dependent on the relationship. And, you know, I've been concerned for a while, I've been writing for a while about the fact that America has been retreating and that we are not that we're in a sort of post Pax Americana world. And I said that I thought it was quite possible that after Pax Americana, there wouldn't be any Pax. That's what's happening. And we have to understand the consequence of that. I mean, this is what I'm thinking of writing about today. David and I share a sort of liberal internationalist instinct. And what this illustrates is that the commitment required to support that is simply from Britain and not just from other allies is simply greater than we, you know, both in public support and financially, than I think we had anticipated. And we either, you know, accept that or we don't pursue that policy. And at the moment, we've been retreating from that policy. And everybody who's retreated from that policy, every single person who's listening to that programme, who has supported that policy of retreat, is responsible for what's happened. This is not something that happened out of the blue. America withdrew as a result of 15 to 20 years of withdrawal-type rhetoric supported on right and on left, that America should not be the world's policeman. And you cannot, when you say that America should not be the world's policeman, when it stops being the world's policeman and someone breaks into the house and starts murdering the occupants because there's no police, you can't say, where's the police, right? Because you said they shouldn't be the world's policeman. And I've always thought they should be the world's policeman. And I feel chagrined and angry that they've decided against that role, that we're not supporting them in that role. But nobody who thinks that they shouldn't play that role has got any right to be at cross with what's happening in Afghanistan, because it's what you wanted.
David, I wonder what you think should happen now in terms of... You mentioned having to talk to the Taliban in some instance, but we're constantly hearing the Prime Minister Boris Johnson. In fact, just a few minutes ago, a readout from Downing Street about his conversation with Angela Merkel about telling the Taliban to protect human rights and the rights of women and girls' education. But it's just words, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. But on the other hand, it's if you like, it's the kind of minimum that you absolutely have to do. We have to make the assumption, we have to operate on the assumption that the Taliban new government, whatever administration it is, will want some kind of contact with the outside world. We need some kind of help. After all, taxing people to pay for your weapons is not exactly the same as taxing people to pay for your infrastructure and for your economy and so on. And there is some suggestion that some of the leading members of the Taliban in places like Doha and also Pakistan have become quite substantial business operators in their own right, with a kind of interest in the economy. So the horrible truth is that they may actually have a vested interest in some sort of way in having at least some kind of active relationship with the West. And that is your sole lever, practically. I mean, obviously, they know that if Al-Qaeda launches attacks from Afghan territory, then in that case, they're going to be hit again. And America does have the capacity to do that, and does have the will to do that without actually losing very many soldiers as a consequence. So, yes, we are going to have to use pressure and persuasion to get people out and to try and get them to behave. better than they would otherwise behave. I don't hold out much hope, though. I mean, I honestly don't on that latter score. It doesn't seem to me from reports we've been hearing that they're very much in control of what's actually happening in towns and villages around Afghanistan.
And in terms of the politics within the Taliban, a little bit later on, we're going to hear from the director of the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London on exactly how they operate and what the power structures and strategies are within the Taliban. We started with meals, both of you. I'm going to end with a drink, if that's OK. Boris Johnson said that he's off the sauce until his new baby is born, in solidarity with his wife, Carrie Johnson. Have you, either of you, tried any of this, a kind of dry January, not drinking through the week, Danny?
If you put all of the contents of everything I've ever, of every alcohol I've ever drunk in my life into a pint glass, it wouldn't reach the rim. So, yes, I'm afraid that I'm not the best person to ask, because I don't drink at all. Not for no reason to do with solidarity with anyone. I just don't really like it. It's a sort of slightly, I think, possibly a symbol of immaturity. I don't like coffee either, but no, I've never liked it very much. So I don't get it completely.
I just take it as an admission that he's got an alcohol problem. I'm not even joking. I think if you have to say to yourself, I need to stop for a while, then the question is, why do you need to stop? Why can't you just have enough of this thing for it not to require you to
stop? As a brief health kick?
Then, if it's unhealthy for you, why do it? I mean, I don't say to myself, I'm going to have a thin January because but it's going to be great to be fat the rest. I dislike being overweight all the year round.
Yes. So you're saying you haven't tried that at any point, David. You haven't said, okay, I'm not going to drink during the week, or I'm going to.
I would have that. It would be completely redundant in my case. I like one glass of red wine, possibly at an extremist two, once a week. What would I be stopping?
Yes. Very finally, sorry, I can just, listeners at home can't see both of you, but I've got you on a screen here. I can see both of you sitting in your respective studies. David, for Christmas, or maybe some kind of autumn sort of fundraiser, shall we buy Danny Finkelstein some shelves?
Well, can I just point out, we're having a house painted, and stacks
of books.
Yes. Because the house is being painted and the books have been taken off the shelf and put in. So the books behind me are here on purpose because they're research material for the book that I'm writing. And the books on the other side are taken off the shelf in the lounge, which is being painted grey, as you asked.
Together with
terracotta in the kitchen and malted chocolate in the bedroom.
You think he should have a shelving September, do you?
Exactly. That was David Finkelstein and Danny Aronovich.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, have you got millions, maybe billions to spare? Here's how you take over a company.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender.
How to to buy a business. Is it all about the dosh? As Morrisons flirts with multiple bidders, we're going to be delving into the tricky takeover. In a moment, we'll hear from Hugh Osmond, who founded Pizza Express, John Cordwell, who founded Phones For You, and Luke Johnson, an entrepreneur, currently chair of Risk Capital Partners, who's been involved with lots of these. We'll hear from them a little bit later on. First, our expert guide in all of this, Ashley Armstrong, retail editor at The Times. Ashley, good morning.
Hi, morning. That was a jazzy intro.
just for you. First of all, update us with the Morrisons situation, because this is a good place to start, isn't it? And the way that these things can, well, is drag out the right word?
Drag out, I think, is fair enough in this situation. So we've been, publicly, Morrisons has been under siege for 2 months. We first knew that Clayton, Dubilier & Rice had made an approach for them in mid-June. What was actually going on behind the scenes was there was another buyout firm called Fortress, who was also in takeover talks. And so there's been a competition between them. Fortress has made 2 offers now. It improved its offer, even though Clayton, Dubilier & Rice or CD&R didn't make an effort. And now we've got a Friday deadline for CD&R to trump the Fortress bid, which has already got the blessing from Morrison's directors. So it really is... kind of show their money or walk away time now.
And what is happening, do we think, behind the scenes as this ticking clock counts down? Is there lots of wrangling amongst, I guess, the board of Morrisons in terms of various people who are actually putting together these bids?
I think most of the tension, as it were, would have probably been done before we had the approval or the recommendation from Fortress, because they made like 5 offers before they made their first public one. And, Morrisons is a supermarket which has got 85% freehold of its assets. It owns its manufacturing sites. It proved its worth during the pandemic. And yet the stock market has really undervalued it. It's been unloved because investors just can't see how there's a way to growth. Supermarkets operate on really low margins, and there's been much more attractive assets out there for institutional investors. So it really kind of puts the point of how much is Morrisons worth. And to give you an idea, so for the last 5 years, Morrisons has been trading around 170, 180p. Now we're thinking that CD&R could come back with a 280p offer. So, there's a big bump involved. Mm. And yet when Fortress was offering 254p, which is obviously a considerable premium to what the shares had been, investors were saying, no, that's not enough, that's undervaluing it, and Morrison's directors could be generating a lot more money. And the supermarket takeover tussle has really pushed into the spotlight, this kind of whole idea of where value is. And if public markets don't value an asset, then private equity or private money certainly will sniff out cheap assets and cheap value. And that's why we're seeing this huge wave of takeovers going on at the moment.
And in terms of takeovers more broadly, why is there so much secrecy?
Well, in terms of kind of what's happening, well, because as soon as there's takeover interest known, that's why people are always very careful about leaks, and the takeover panel has now got big punitive pressures to stop leaks from happening. Then the share price goes up. And also, there's been criticism of maybe why didn't Morrisons let investors know that there was all this takeover interest in them before agreeing to a deal, because they had been accused of rolling over and accepting an offer too quickly. Well, there's this whole concept of being under siege. So actually, if a company says as soon as that somebody comes along and knocks on the door that they've got an offer or takeover interest, then they're kind of in somebody else's hands constantly. Their fortune is dictated by whether this takeover offer comes. And it's incredibly disruptive to businesses, and particularly those that employ, hundreds of thousands of staff, because they're wondering, well, if somebody comes along, will I have a job in a couple of months? Will my job be safe? And it means that, suppliers kind of hold off doing deals. So, the ripple effects of a takeover really are why secrecy is so important, but why as journalists we always like knowing what's going on.
And in terms of what you've seen and what you've reported on over the years, give an example of a particularly spicy or complicated takeover.
Almost in the same sector, as it were. Sainsbury's Asda was obviously a big deal and a big deal that wasn't, you know, and that was definitely one of those situations where maybe the supermarkets really were too confident in thinking that they could merge the second and third largest grocers. I'm not quite sure why everybody had said it was going to be impossible, but they believed it was. And then you also had, obviously, the Unilever situation with Kraft Heinz, which was another amazing, very short-lived deal that wasn't. Because, you know, Unilever was able to say, you know, these ugly Americans in Brazilian outfit, they'll slash and burn our company and, you know, destroy all our ethical principles. And it worked, you know. And we had a similar situation with Pfizer AstraZeneca as well. So, yeah, it's almost the deals that weren't have almost been as interesting as the big deals that have happened.
And amidst all of this, of course, we've got shareholders in the middle of this. How, if I am the entrepreneur with hundreds of millions of pounds in my back pocket and I'm trying to buy a big name on the high street, how worried do I need to be about shareholders? And is that worry increasing over the past few years?
Well, if you're trying to buy a high street business, I would say there's not many left.
Well, yeah, good point. Yeah, bad example.
So you know, there's and the ones that are probably quite expensive. And you know, you've got the likes of Next, and I suppose Frasers Group is basically owned by my cashly majority owned JD Sports. You know, that's just like is also largely owned by the Pentland Group. If you're talking about kind of, you know, another listed business for shareholders, I mean, what we've seen, particularly in the Morrison situation, and you're seeing playing out with other deals, is that, you know, institutional investors have been talking this game for a while about, you know, considering wider stakeholders and they like sustainable investments. At the end of the day, it really does come down to their fiduciary duty to their investors, and so they will always take the highest price. And you know, they might hold off and not want to deal, but that's because they think that there'll be a better financial return. It's very hard for an investor to say no to money today. And that's part of the problem that boards have as well when they're trying to rebuff a deal, that because they might want to stay independent. They have to consider the shareholder interests almost above and beyond their wider stakeholders as much as they have to, because the thing is that wider stakeholders, it's quite difficult for them to pursue it, but actually shareholders can sue boards for not, you know, kind of thinking of their best interests and blindly turning away a deal that could, you know, could reach it. Actually, we had this similar situation with Premier Foods a while ago. They rebuffed this takeover approach, that it was never a full bid, but from a US suitor, and did a side deal with a Japanese firm selling a stake to him. And it infuriated the shareholders so much that for the next 4 years they were subject to activist shareholder campaigns. I mean, investors hate it if boards. It's a real difficult balance for them to strike, because they'll hate it if they haven't given due consideration to a takeover offer, and investors also hate it if there's the idea of selling too cheap. So, yeah, it's a tough one.
Very, very, very finally, Ashley, Breakfast are doing this thing where they're giving sort of policymakers an imaginary £1 billion to sort of see what good they do in their field. I'm going to give you £1 billion in a sort of fancy way now. What are you buying?
Oh, wow.
Business-wise.
Business-wise, yeah. Okay. Well, if I had £1 billion, this is very interesting. But I think £1 billion, well, you couldn't buy a listed business that's worth it for £1 billion right now. You'd probably buy a stake. So I think I would probably go down the line of venture capitalism, because that seems to be where you can also make a lot of money these days, and probably do buy some of these high street brands or some of these unloved brands or these consumer-y brands these days, and build up a little stable, and then I'd probably rebrand it as a tech business, because I'd sell online and have some logistics. And if you can rebrand anything as a technology platform, you know, you can at least kind of, you know, add a huge multiple to your price. So, I'd make my money back by trying to set up a tech platform, I think.
That was a very good answer, very detailed. You've been thinking about that.
No, I haven't, but maybe I will. If you've got a spare billion, I'll take it.
Well, if anyone's listening has got a spare billion, do throw some Ashley's way. Ashley, thank you so much for your time. That's Ashley Armstrong, who is a retail editor at the time. Let's hear from people who've actually been involved in this kind of thing. Hugh Osmond founded Pizza Express. John Cordwell founded Phones For You. And Luke Johnson is an entrepreneur who's currently chair of Risk Capital Partners. Obviously been involved in a number of restaurant and food chains. Welcome all. Ah, no one's there.
you're looking for a reaction, yes. Hi.
Hello. Thank you all so much for making time for us. I appreciate it. Hugh, can I start with you? In terms of Pizza Express, take us through some of the buying and selling and the shenanigans that went on there in your time.
Well, as you know, Luke and I actually did that together, what seems like an awful long time ago now. Actually, it only seems like yesterday, but that was in 92, 93. Mm. And I think, you know, that was an example, which in a way is the best. And although, you know, there was a lot of work, the easiest example where you have essentially a very, very good company. And by freeing it from its shackles, it can blossom. And although I would like to think that Luke and I had considerable input into that, it was, in essence, an outstanding company to start with, and we could simply, by providing it with extra funding and extra freedom and extra resources, allow this very solid company that was crying to get out blossom. And it was a very favourable market. It was a very good company. It was a very good brand, and we backed the people and the management, and hence it went very well. Many takeovers don't go that well, as Luke and I can both vouch for, and I'm sure John as well.
And Luke, in terms of the Pizza Express experience, was it always about price? It was interesting what Ashley was saying there about actually whatever sort of assurances are given in terms of how the business is going to run, actually shareholders quite often are just going for the highest bidder. Is that fair in your experience?
Hugh and I were part of a consortium that took control of the business from the founder, so it was a private company. We took it
public. Luke, we can barely hear you, I'm afraid. Maybe could you edge us a little closer to your microphone? You sound like you're at the end of a very long corridor.
How's that? Is that better?
Yes, much better. Thank you. Sorry, as you were.
Okay, so it was a private business. We took control of it from the founders and took it public. And as Hugh said, it was quite small when we first got involved, and we grew it organically. And that's really what added the value and made the difference. And in hindsight, the price we paid was almost irrelevant because of the growth it enjoyed. And so it was a good example of how you can pay up in the beginning if you've got a good enough business and the climate is right.
And Hugh, tell us about your experience. John, getting confused between the wall. John, God, tell us about your experience, first of all, in terms of founding Phones For You, and then when it came to the point where you sold. Tell us about that experience of hearing from different bidders and what your experience of that was.
Yeah, well, I think first of all, I think you mentioned about acquisitions, and the whole world is full of chief executives who think that 2 + 2 is going to equal 5, and they find out much to their demise that 2 + 2 often equals 3. So acquisitions and mergers have got to be very, very carefully and thoughtfully done, because you will often end up with completely diverse cultures that are a nightmare to knit together, a whole range of problems, and that economy of scale that you think that you might be building and taking cost out of the business ends up actually being the reverse, and you've maybe put 12 months of your life into making it happen. But that wasn't the question you asked me, so I will answer that as well, which was on the sale process. I was dealing with one of the shrewdest negotiators on the planet, really, with Vodafone. They had a very, very simple strategy of starving their associates out of business or making things difficult for them in order to buy the business cheaply. And I knew exactly what they were going to do with me. And I actually gave them a nuclear button scenario whereby if they screwed me over or tried to, the nuclear button would be pressed, which would be extremely damaging for me, but extremely damaging for them, in the hope that they would play reasonably fair. And that ultimately is what happened. And Vodafone actually got a real bargain when they bought Single Point, because they bought such a great business that they relocated a lot of their services into my business in Stoke-on-Trent. So that sort of worked out well for both parties. But it's a battle. It's a battlefield out there, you know, and especially if you're dealing with a big, shrewd player who's played the game many times and knows how to manipulate. And when I sold the whole business, I had the same tough fights all over again with private equity. Ended up selling in two parts. One was to Provident Private Equity, and the other one was the distribution business, which was Doughty, and that went badly for them, unfortunately. But whereas Providence consulted me on the way to knit the business in and make it work and motivate the management team, Doughty has decided not to, and I think that was part of their demise.
And I'm interested in how things have maybe changed over the years. Hjorsman, you were talking about you and Luke Johnson's buying Pizza Express in, you said it was 92-93. How much has the process changed, do you think, have you observed over the years, in terms of not just the publicity around these kind of things, but also the way that shareholders maybe have become a bit more active as well, would you say?
Well, I think the process has moved on. You know, the rules and regulations around public company takeovers are very strict, and contrary perhaps to the narrative, they're incredibly favourable to the vendors. The vendors get, you know, every possible chance for the best bidder to come forward, and you know, the bidders have to follow a very strict set of rules. As I say, there is a very clear period where other bidders get the chance to come in. There's very little ability to tie deals up. So if you are a shareholder in a public company and it gets bid for, you can be absolutely certain, or pretty much certain, that every bidder who might be out there will get a good chance to look. They will have the rights to all the same information as other bidders get. And the days of the kind of Wild West in the public companies of bidding here or there are pretty much over. I'm not sure that always is best for British business as a whole, because I think it enables some rather second-rate management quite often to get, you know, to get away with it and not get taken over simply because of the process. But that has definitely moved on. And even with private companies, I think things have moved on a lot, in that there's far less ability to do deals by private, you know, one-on-one negotiation. Far more is done, even with quite small businesses, by auction. Again, you know, that's good in some ways, and it maybe enables the vendors to be sure they got a fair price. But I think sometimes, in terms of who the right bidder is and the communication that John just referred to about whether you've got a bidder who's really interacting well with the vendor and with the existing shareholders,
yeah,
it's not always right for the business.
I'm interested in all of your experiences as most of you, in terms of being buyers. Luke Johnson, obviously you're long associated with buying lots of businesses. I'm thinking of Feng Sushi, the company that runs Gales, and the rest. Tell us about your experience of that, and I guess what we're after is sort of some of the behind the scenes secretive drama that happens that maybe doesn't make it into the newspapers and onto the television screens.
Well, in my experience, every deal is full of thrills and spills, because despite what people think, there is a great deal of emotion involved always, and there are often last minute hitches and hiccups and confrontations. And, you know, while most deals develop a momentum that means they finally get closed, there will always be a lot of tension before that happens, that obviously never makes it to the media. But if you are involved, then it's a stressful business. And quite often you will imagine that either the deal doesn't happen, or you're outbid, or that the bidder pulls out, or the financing doesn't come through. You know, these are unusual times, because people don't need this money out there. And with incredibly low interest rates and governments printing money everywhere, I think this autumn will be perhaps the busiest few months ever in takeover terms, because I think there are going to be a great deal of bids because of all this liquidity across the world.
Hmm. And Hugh, just to go back to you, I'm interested, what's happening with you and Homebase? It was reported a while ago that you were eyeing up buying Homebase. Maybe that, and also your experience of trying to buy things. And do you agree with Luke's point there about this autumn is maybe necessarily the time to do it?
Yeah, in the case of Homebase, I mean, we simply didn't reach agreement on price. We felt it was too uncertain as to how much of the incredible boom in sales was as a result of specific lockdown factors, where Homebase was open when many other people were closed. And understandably, the owners felt that was sustainable, so we couldn't reach agreement on price. I agree with Luke. I mean, I think it's not a very sexy subject, but it's incredibly important. The amount of liquidity that's been pumped in all around the world, but particularly starting the US, is absolutely staggering. And you know, the kind of real interest rates and hence cost of debt and money available to investors is the lowest, you know, by far it's ever been in our lifetimes. And this money swishing around all over the place looking for a home, you know, will have all sorts of consequences, which, you know, I can't possibly forecast, and neither can any economist either. So, you know, it could be incredibly busy because money is available everywhere. Some good deals will be done. Some terrible deals will be done. But it could be very, very busy. This cheap money, I suspect, eventually will end badly. But how long the party goes on before it does, anybody's guess.
John Cordwell, I'll end with you. We were hearing from Ashley Armstrong from the Times a minute ago. I gave her a fantasy £1 billion to buy something in this autumn acquisition spree, which may be upon us. I'm giving you a fancy. Well, you've got your own billion, but I'm giving you a fancy one as well. What's taking your fancy?
Well, I mean, firstly, I've always been an organic grower. I don't like buying other businesses. It would have to be something very, very special for me to want to buy from scratch. From an existing business. So, but if it were, it would have to be something that was globalized. So it would have to be internet-based. It would have to be in its infancy, but proven. And I'd have to be able to see that it could be mass market and a globalized business. Other than that, I would never invest in another business on a significant scale. Of course, I'm an investor in a small way, as small shareholdings of 1%, 2%, or 3%. But they have to be capable of being globalized so that the upside is enormous. Mm. Even if risk is quite big as well, the upside makes it really worth going for.
Good to talk to you all this morning. Thank you so much for making time for us. John Cordwell there, who, of course, founded Phones for You back in the day. Also heard from Luke Johnson, entrepreneur, currently chair of Risk Capital Partners, and also Hugh Osmond, with whom Luke Johnson bought Pizza Express way back in the early 90s as well. And there we go. That's all we've got time for. Thanks very much for listening. Do download the podcast again tomorrow. We will be taking a trip round disunited Afghanistan in a departure from our usual fare. Liking and subscribing and all that helps. I'm at Luke Jones. On Twitter. See you tomorrow.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two.
Tiny Women with Gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.